This episode is sponsored by Transcend, a veteran-owned and operated performance optimization company that I introduced recently as a sponsor on this show. Well, since then, I have actually been using my products and I have had incredible success. There was initial blood work that was extremely detailed, and based on that, they offered supplementation. So I began taking DHEA, BPC-157 for inflammation, based on the fact that I've been a stuntman, a martial artist, and a firefighter my whole life, lots of aches and pains, Dihexa to help cognition after multiple punches to the head and shift work, and peptides. 4 months later, they did a detailed blood work again, and I was actually able to taper off two of the peptides because my body had responded so well to just one of them that it was optimized at that point. So I cannot speak highly enough of the immense range of supplementation that they offer, whether it's male health, female health, peptides to boost your own testosterone, which I would argue is needed by a lot of the fire service, or whether it's exogenous testosterone needed, especially after TBIs or advanced age. Now, as I mentioned before, the other side of this company is an altruistic arm called the Transcend Foundation, which is putting veterans and first responders through some of their protocols free of charge. Now, Transcend are also offering you, the audience, 10% off their protocols. And you can find that on jamesgearing.com under the products tab. And if you want to hear more about Transcend and their story, listen to episode 808 with the founder, Ernie Colling, or go to transcendcompany.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back for the third time ocean lifeguard and the man behind Never Off Duty, Jason Bitzer. Now, in this third conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from the neuroblastoma diagnosis his young son James had, immunotherapy versus radiation and chemo, fitness standards in the lifeguarding community, the prevalence of shark attacks, the importance of trauma kits, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,000 episodes now. And I also want to put one more thing in. I don't normally do this in my intros, but today I released my second book, Kinder, which you can find on ebook and paperback on Amazon.com or Amazon in your country. So with that being said, I welcome back onto the show, Jason Bitzer. Enjoy. Well, Jason, I want to start by saying welcome back to the Behind the Shield podcast. We had a phenomenal conversation last time, and I know we're going to unpack some new topics today. But firstly, I just want to welcome you back.
Thanks, James. I love going on this podcast because I get to hear from other angles to other professions and kind of adapt it to what my expertise is. So it's good. I love listening to the podcast too, so I appreciate it.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
I'm actually back in my hometown after 22 plus years. I purchased a home in Manasquan, New Jersey, and I'm back here now, pretty much settled with my family for my son's healthcare, but doing good. My kids are in school and kind of just, you know, normal family life, just not in Hawaii right now.
Well, speaking of your son, I think that'd be a good place to start. Since we did the last episode, obviously your little boy started having some health issues. So kind of walk me through as a parent what you saw, because I think these stories are really important in case someone else, you know, sees the same thing in their own child. And then walk me through the diagnosis, some of the self-advocacy that you forged to make sure that he got the best care. And then let's talk about where he is now.
Yeah, so being on an island, you know, like it's one of those things in Hawaii that it's such a wonderful place, but it has its limitations. And we got blindsided back in February of 2023, where my son was perfectly healthy, literally days and weeks before. He just suddenly stopped walking. It seemed he had like some type of inflammation, just kind of to speed up through the process of what happened is he stopped walking one day after a beach day. And we thought maybe it was the sand, just, you know, soreness. They thought it was synovitis, which is a typically in boys post-viral syndrome. They ruled that out. Sent him back home. Another week went by. He was doing better. Went to do another beach day. Went back in. Same issue. After a litany of trying to fight with different scans, because just the way it is, and it's no fault of their own, the medical system will start with one part of the body and move on. They're not just going to go to a full body MRI or PET scan or something. They're going to kind of go, you know, by the numbers because of costs and just the way the protocols were run. We went through the process. We got a bone aspiration, and long story short, sadly, he was diagnosed with stage 4 neuroblastoma, which is an extremely rare cancer. 1 in 1.7 million, the last I checked. And stage 4 because of his age and also because of his bone marrow. When we come to find out, it was 85% of his bone marrow. So it had metastasized from a very small tumor on his left adrenal gland. And come to find later when we got to New York, a little bit of his lymphs were affected. But it does a lot of the times with neuroblastoma go to the adrenal glands. It sounds like neurological because neuro, but it's not. It can kind of find its way into any part of the body, but fortunately it was in the spot that it's the normal place where they look to as far as the soft tissue, but the bone marrow was very prevalent. They do a score called a Keurig score out of 25. We were at an 18, so we were super high. Very, very, very daunting, especially when we didn't understand the disease. And what we did is we basically looked at the options. I actually canceled a surgery in front of the surgeon just because I didn't feel confident of, no offense to anyone, that of the knowledge base of this disease in Hawaii. They didn't treat it much. They had two studies and they basically were looking at the sky saying, hey, this one's going to make your son sterile and deaf, and so will this one, and we don't know the outcome. The doctor there, even within our first 15 minutes of talking, said, yeah, this is one of those diseases where we need to talk about the ethics of treating, where it gets to where we just don't treat anymore because it's not ethical. So those are the first conversations we're having there. No offense to them. It's just, you know, I have a very high fighting attitude. I'm not going to take no for an answer. I'm not going to just take a defeat before we even start. And in that process, I actually fortunately got a call from Sloan outside of network just to have a quick consult while I was about to go into surgery with my son. And I saw a 201 number and I just picked it up on speaker and handed it to a very great doctor in Hawaii too, which was very affable to speak to them, not knowing it was going to be our doctor later. I thought it was just an admin person. But that conversation, I tried to listen as intently as I could, and I canceled treatment in Hawaii. We put in the port there, and under Sloan's guidance, we did the first round of chemo, and then we were on a plane early April, late March, and made the move with basically four boxes to go to Sloan Kettering. And through that whole process, we've just been learning about the disease and kind of trying to pick up the pieces where we could, so to say. So that got us, you know, that got us there.
How old was James at that point?
So he had just turned 3 in November. So neuroblastoma is weird. And I'll give some details. And again, I'm not a doctor, so do your own research, but we found some interesting things just because a lot of the information that was being delineated to us, mostly when someone's an infant to one, they don't worry about neuroblastoma. They let it go just because it usually processes out, the tumor will go away and it won't be an issue. Once they get to 2.5, 3, it jumps pretty quickly to stage 4 because the tumor is matured. And that's wild. But then I, you know, come to find, like, what's the differentiating between a 2.5-year-old, 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old? And it's breastfeeding, right? So mother's milk. And something we found over the last 6 months through my hunch that colostrum would help his gut health from all the antibiotics and things that they give him. My wife ran with that and found a derivative called lactoferrin, which is they spin it in a centrifuge. And this material drops out and it's an iron binder, which helped him through his chemo when he had a relapse. And it boosted his blood counts, you know, really off the chart for how much treatment he was getting. So right now, a lot of different parents are using it because it's benign when it comes to interactions with any of the Western treatments. And it's a big inflammation, you know, just it drops inflammation great. There, you know, the blood counts go up, the iron goes up, all the neutropenic things that happen with chemo lessen. So we've come to find some really cool stuff, and I'm just very blessed to have a biologist as a wife, scientist as a wife, that kind of backs my crazy ideas because it's starting to work, you know?
That's interesting to say that. I just flash back to growing up on a farm. My dad was a veterinary surgeon, and I remember ice cube trays filled with colostrum. And I think if I remember rightly, they used to, you know, defrost it, and then we'd bottle feed the young lambs that were struggling. So that does make a huge amount of sense.
It does, yeah. And kind of like, you know, they're going to have to do more studies, but my wife found white papers that were being studied in India, and they were using it with high-grade curcumin, which is turmeric, but like not synthesized, but really, you know, like a very strong derivative of it. And the two combined help with radiation effects and actually help chemo find the tumor cells. So it's weird how it's just such a natural thing, but actually it's helping the Western, but also on the back end on a daily just helps general health and gut health and all the things and the inflammation markers.
So what's interesting is I've had this conversation many, many times coming from a basal medical perspective, because I'm not, you know, an MD, I'm certainly not a specialist, We're taught, you know, a lot more of the building blocks. And when you think about certainly, you know, the 80s, 90s treatment of cancer, basically it's agent oranging the entire human body and then fingers crossed that it's going to survive. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know?
That's what we were doing essentially the first 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're breaking them down to build them up.
Absolutely. So then I'm hearing more now about the immunotherapy, which sounds like it's a lot more promising. So what was that spectrum of treatments that James went through?
So they started with, and it makes sense because I asked this right when I got there. I said, why, if chemo is known to do what it does and immunotherapy is working, why are we doing chemo and immunotherapy versus immunotherapy? The theory behind it is that when cells are rapidly growing, you need to freeze them in their tracks, which does have a lot of validity. And then the immunotherapy on the back end teaches your immune system to fight that specific cancer. So whether it's, you know, it could be a certain type of leukemia, or it could be a certain type of melanoma, or for in our case, neuroblastoma. There's targeted things on the end that help the GD2 and find that and actually target and fight it. So I love immunotherapy. It is a very intense procedure, but the juice is worth the squeeze. It's what cleared him. It cleared him with this one that Sloan specifically got the research with. It's called 3F8, and it's just because that's the number that they found. But the 3F8 was a humanized version of the dinotoxinamide, which is the one they found before, which was a chimera, which the body can uptake, but it also can reject depending on the person. So this one was a much more intense, the 3F8. It's done over an hour versus 12 hours. It worked really well. And unfortunately, it cleared him. Fortunately, it cleared him after 2 months, but he had a very small relapse, clearing in September, and then having a relapse in February of bony material in his left humerus. So it was very heavy news, but I wasn't, you know, just my knowledge base of the disease grew. And then we went back into Dynotux, and what they do is they switch. So that way you don't get resistant to one or the other. And I was always wondering, why wouldn't you stick with one that's already working? But it's just like anything. It's like your body gets adjusted and then the efficacy. So they're very good about managing on how they use their tools. So that's why we went to Sloan specifically from the Western side.
So what about emotionally, mentally? You know, obviously James is there doing all the fighting himself and going through the suffering, but that takes a toll on siblings, on parents, and then obviously the patient as well. So walk me through, you know, those elements, because they don't seem to be as discussed as, you know, the actual chemistry is going on.
Yeah, I think as a parent, there's only so much you can take as far as watching. You know, unfortunately, I just don't want to candy coat this, because if anyone is preparing for this or have been through this, your experience is extremely relevant, because it's the only thing I could think of that's even comparable is being at war. But I almost think it's worse than it, because it's your own child and there's no target to fight. So you're stuck in this conundrum of decision making without a determinate outcome. You don't know what your decision now, if it's going to be successful or not, but you do need to make a decision on their behalf and advocate for them, and the stress of that. And then also being surrounded, it's like, this is, it's a bad way to think of it, or it's a bad terminology, but it's the only way I can think about it. It's like, if you want to see clowns, you got to go to the circus. And if you go to a cancer ward, you're going to see a lot of children with cancer. So the thing is if you're going to the place where the negativity is, you have to have a very strong mind to stay positive in that foxhole. And it's very difficult. I have, from my experience of being a first responder, being in critical situations, probably a little bit more resilience to stress than most people, but it definitely, I had my moments of very close to breaking. My wife obviously, was there multiple times, but I had to be there to keep her up. One of the things that you don't really account for when you jump into this is that yes, you're in your own battle, but because there's parents surrounding, you're going to support each other. And you will see some with success and some with loss. And it's, you cheer the wins and you mourn the losses. And they're both constant and sometimes disturbing. So we've lost two friends along the way that were very, 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 very like to this day. And I think indefinitely will be very hard. And I can't imagine for the parents because how like James became friends with them. We got close. Some of them I thought were going to be out of the woods in a better position than James with different diseases, but similar getting treated and procedural things go wrong. And, you know, something goes right when it should have gone left, infection sets in. And then, you know, it's just the way the world works. It's just, who knows? Like there's a lot of happenstance in the medical world that you can't predict as good as you could see someone one day and then the next day they're gone. And that can be from a car accident, it can be from, you know, cardiac arrest. You just don't know. So life is fragile and this makes us even more so aware of it. So yeah, that was one thing that I would say is just like, prepare your mind for unthinkable amount of things that you're going to come across. And it's not just going to be your own world. It's going to be the world that you're brought into, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. And I appreciate that perspective. I think one of the things that I've seen from Make-A-Wish kids that have come to the station when I've worked there, and then, you know, obviously videos from, you know, from social media of incredible young boys and girls that are going through this, is the seemingly incredible strength that these young people have. Whereas, you know, as you get older, you know, I'm sure we would exhibit our suffering a lot more. So what did you witness, not just in James, but in the ward, as far as this young resilience that seems to be forged there?
They're definitely like beyond my heroes. I think I understand why that is, not just because they're young. It's just that when you're a child, your next play date or your next thing is really your worldview. Whereas you haven't had, you know, 20 to 40 years of adulthood that could kind of crush a man's spirit on the day-to-day life. So it's hard to like sometimes muster up a fight within a fight. Whereas a child just wants to hang out with his buddies, and they don't have the they don't have that worldview of, whereas like they're not looking at the tree and going to hit it, you know what I mean? Like they're not looking at the negative, they're only looking at the positive. So as bad as things may be, they have a really good perspective of how to look beyond it. And if you give them, I try to be like him, meaning like I would be like, okay, if James can be positive, I can be positive. So even if I have to force that, I'm not going to look at him and have him see me droopy eyed and crying and just upset and add to a negative situation when he's not that way. That doesn't make any sense. And that's hard to tell a parent to do that, but it is a necessity. So I tried to look at things of like, what is needed for this child to stay positive in the worst situation. And so a lot of the times we would just play for hours. Like we'd be up till midnight because he couldn't sleep. But if I could distract him and he had the energy, we'd be just playing, whatever he wanted to do. And, you know, in your stress, sometimes the last thing you want to do, like your finances are dropping, your job's falling apart, the last thing you want to do is play, but you're going to have to follow your child's lead. And what energy they give you, you need to match and not bring that down. You know, and sometimes when they are down, you got to figure a way to get them up. Even if it's beyond you, it's like you can do it. You just have to kind of put your brain on the side and do what you need to do. Like, you know, just go against your natural reaction to the situation.
Absolutely. And what about James? How's he doing now?
He's great. We have, we cleared scans last week for the second one in a row, thank God. And he did treatment last week and we just got scheduled for his final treatment of this course. So that will be September 9th. And then we scan in October. And I don't, when I did this, I don't want people to understand, like, I don't look at things of anything ever being done. It's just everything in life is a continued process. That means we're very positive. He's doing great. Cancer's not coming back in my mind. We're going to stay in this pocket. But I just have to look at everything day by day now. So like we're making plans, but they're always interchangeable. So, you know, he scans in October. If everything's clear, we're going to go visit in Hawaii and actually take a family vacation in November. But we've been there before. So like we just go, whatever happens, is as long as he's happy and smiling and my daughter's happy and smiling, I really, the rest is just like semantics. We just go with the flow and do the best we can kind of thing.
Beautiful. And then what about your daughter? One last thing. When I've heard, especially in this case, you know, when one of the siblings is going through something so brutal, obviously the focus is going to be on that child a lot and that sibling can feel left out.
Yes. So she's a champ. She went from never tying her shoes in her whole life from Hawaii to living in the Upper East Side of New York and riding on subways in a blink of an eye. So her ability to adapt is wonderful. That doesn't mean the psychological effect of seeing her go through this is not daunting or relevant, because she dealt with it. She went to 3 schools already and finally got settled. She moved from, you know, her island home into New York City and then into family and friends houses and then rentals and then finally getting settled within a 6-month period. And, you know, she's doing great though. She's surfing again. She's playing sports. She's getting really good at softball. The one good thing is her education. She really kind of buckled down and she's doing really well in school. So I have absolutely admiration for her, because I don't know how things are going to pan out. You try, but you just don't know. And she's done very well. It is hard because he gets a lot of attention and he needs it, but she's also very caring and loving towards him, even in spite of her maybe getting neglected sometimes. But what I do is I try to, like, so for example, a very nice person who I just met had given us tickets to a Yankees game, and she's really big into softball and baseball. So I'll make time where I'm like, okay, these 3 hours, we're going to go to this, what you like. And, you know, we swap moms. So we figure out ways so that way she's because when they're in the same room, even just as a young sibling always gets the attention anyway. As the one gets to adolescence, it's like they're independent. So they start getting less and less. And at that age of 10 years old, you're not quite a teenager where you're independent and you're not quite, you know, the baby anymore. So you're like in this weird space. You have to juggle. So we're learning, but we feel like we're doing a fairly good job of it.
Beautiful. Well, let's transition to the world of lifeguarding now. We have several things that we're going to discuss, but sadly, I mean, you spent your whole career lifeguarding on the ocean. I spent my early career lifeguarding on pools, water parks and lakes, so never on the ocean, but, you know, have a lifeguarding background again. And we had that absolute tragedy in CrossFit where Lazar Dukic was, you know, drowned and seemingly in front of lifeguards. So this isn't a blame game. Obviously, you know, they're sadly sometimes it's just that perfect storm of all the wrong elements. But from a lifeguard perspective, obviously what's important is to learn from lessons and make sure it doesn't happen again. So talk to me about that event through your eyes.
So, like, good or bad, every time I've done a large major production or event, there's a debrief. But more importantly, there's a safety meeting prior. I wasn't there, so I'm not going to armchair quarterback response or logistics, because that's hard. I'm assuming there was a medic team there. It's a big organization. I've trained CrossFit for over a decade. I love the modalities. I do like that type of group workout. I like all of it. I like the competition side of things. It's all good. It's very like lifeguard centric, even though they're not lifeguards in that sense, but a lot of lifeguards like that type of training modality. The erg, all those things are great, you know, things that we do as well. I will say though, I didn't see a lifeguard on the water. So I'll let, you know, that flesh itself out as the investigation goes, because I'm sure there will be one. That's the type of thing that happens in deposition. And that's why I'll reserve judgment. But I will say the first things first, there was a loss of life. So let's respect that. It's very sad. Now, was there a medical condition? Was there panic? The video looked like that competitor wasn't, you know, a very competent water person, and they're under a lot of duress from the stress of the workout. Now, should you exclude someone that doesn't have water capability? Yes, no, I'm not sure. They should definitely do a screening for that. If they did, great, good on them. If they didn't, that's something that should have been thought about. Secondly, when I do water safety of something of that nature, when it's kind of a setup for a run, swim, run, or a distance swim, an open water swim, a lake paddle, so anything that has water apparatus, at minimum, you need a front lead and a back lead lifeguard, meaning that so that there's no one left behind. There should be a third in the middle, because in those packs, whether it's an Ironman or it's a fun swim or whatever it may be, you need eyes like on a 1-to-8 ratio, really. So ratios are important. Attention span's important. Equipment's important. So maybe they didn't need a jet ski, but someone on a rescue board on front and back at minimum. I would have had three for that type of thing, doing loops, and then with someone catching from like a just a like a very good visual apparatus. And there should someone be in a perch as well, watching. So physical. It's also good to have, these days they even have AI to back you up. So if you had some type of camera that could, they do those things where they dictate stress. So even if you had someone managing a monitor to see blind spots. But again, I'm a safety risk management specialist. I go overboard. That's what I do, because I'd rather spend an extra couple thousand dollars at the event, not lose a life, and spend millions on the legal aspect of everything. So I'm always front ending everything. I do see this a lot. No offense to CrossFit. I see a lot of lax in general when it comes to production events, whatever it may be. Not so much in like Hollywood, because they're very great about that, but I do see it in non-union, non-based, just event production, where they cut corners in the wrong area. You know, they might spend a ton of money on production value, but then their safety is marginal. EMT at best, if they're lucky. EMR, volley services, something like that. They're not paying attention to it. And that bothers me, because that's the athlete. Does that make sense? So
no, it does.
In my opinion, it's first things first, safety first. We always say it, but it doesn't really get the attention that it's needed. When you have an EMT, not to be offensive, or a medic on staff, but that's an oh shit element. That's not a preventative measure when it comes to aquatic safety. You're going to need to have specific water safety that works with the ancillary safety team for if and when something does happen, that they back them up and transport. But you need, one, prevention, and two, the proper equipment, three, the proper certified staff. And hopefully this changes things, because it has to, because I would hate to see this happen again. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I mean, I've only seen that one video clip, which there's a few tragic things. There appears to be people that seem like lifeguards around. One is seemingly staring, you know, at him when it happens. And I just remember, and we're talking again, like absolute basic, this is what you learn in the pool when you become a lifeguard. But just, you know, if someone is vertical in the water, you know, and they're bobbing, and that was what it seemed to be. And so, you know, we talked before we hit record. Again, this is just unpacking it, not blaming anyone. I mean, I wasn't there, and even the video is very grainy, and you can't be completely inclusive from that one thing. But
did you see anyone with like a rescue can or tube? I didn't see that.
I can't remember if someone was holding, but I mean, it seemed like there were some sort of water staff, and again, what the actual search warrant experience.
Well, no, exactly, and that's why I reserve judgment. First things first, you know, the bereavement of somebody passed. That's worse. The worst thing is losing an athlete during competition. But from like my professional, you can always do more, so you should have a minimum standard, and the records of any event will be like, hey, did you have a safety briefing prior? Did you have one with all the team? Who was involved? Where were your setups? You know, what were the communications like? Were they in place? Because the thing is they need to be designated. They can't be part of the production staff. Those are two separate entities, and they need to be treated as such. There's one that needs to focus just on safety, and one that does everything else. So that way the production team has nothing to, they just go, hey, we're all on the same page and done, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I know, you know, when I, with lifeguard, when you see someone in trouble, you know, you almost have to be careful not to lock in on them. You want to still be scanning, but you're obviously concerned about that person. And then I think about as an athlete, when I've done, there's been occasions where I've done a workout at a pool, when you realize that, yeah, when you're, and I'm not even a great swimmer as far as long distances, you know, I swam to lifeguard, to be honest. I was never a competitive swimmer, but I was, you know,
when you are swimming and only swimming, you get into that cadence, you try and be efficient, you know, and then you're sprinting, obviously, if you're getting close to someone. But apart from that, you know, you should be leaving somewhat fresh, and then you make the rescue. Doing, yeah. you know, a workout or possibly 1 or 2 days full of workouts prior to that is a completely different animal. So, and yeah, then yeah, you've got yeah. that other factor of don't touch them, because if you touch them, then you're going to disqualify them. You know, there's all these factors now that a person may think that they're strong, but then they find themselves fatigued at the end of a race where maybe they went too hard and yeah. now they're in trouble. Or like you said, it was a seizure or a cardiac event or medical. Something else.
Yeah, yeah. You never know. And the one thing is, though, is in those high intensity type of workouts that are CrossFit based, I personally think they should know that there should have been like a 1-to-8 ratio trailing that group coming in. Because, you know, it doesn't take more than 45 seconds for someone to go underwater. You know what I mean? So it's like you need to be on proximity, or you're going to be, especially in a lake or a river, like it's good luck finding the body if they go under. You know what I mean? So it's like it's there's got to be stop gaps put in place for that regardless. And I'm not picking on them. It's a tragedy. They didn't want this to happen, obviously. It's not like they woke up to ran this wonderful event and they thought, oh, today's the day we're going to lose one of our competitors. That's not the case. It's just when you add water into the element of sport, you know, like example, the Olympics, right? The most dangerous elements water could possibly be at Chopu. And they had an extremely good team. The Tahitian Water Patrol, I've trained with the Hawaiian Water Patrol for decades. They're pioneers, best people on the planet to do that job. And look, everyone came home safe. And that's in a place where people die. Like they can die there. Pipeline, Chopu, people can die. So there's ways to do it, and we know how to do it. It's not like the concept hasn't been proven. It's just that the generic public that are outside of like the surf life-saving space, they don't really give it credence. And I've ran into it too. They don't want to pay. They don't want to add to it. They think it's nothing. They just kind of lackadaisically think. And then we lose somebody, and you know, you lose your reputation, you lose your brand. Worst thing is you lose, obviously, the patient. I can't reiterate that enough, but you know, you're cutting your nose off to spite your face, not doing this the right way. It's not the way.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, again, perfect examples from our collective professions is look at Valdi, you know,
yeah.
I mean, this is when you don't take it seriously, when you're not proactive, when you're not training, you're not communicating with your agencies around you, it will happen. And the last place I worked at, if they don't figure out their shit, the same thing's going to happen there. And that's one of the things that was so frustrating. And we almost had the pulse shooting where I used to work, which is Disney Springs. That's where he went first. And by a miracle, there was so many police officers there that day. He got back in his car, and not a miracle for the poor people in the Pulse nightclub.
I was just there. I look at it too, because I write EAPs and stand in place and shelter in place protocols for big resorts and like aquatic properties mainly. But yeah. And then when you think about it just on the medical side, like you think of like Damar Hamlin, they had a huge team around him, cardiac arrest saved. And then there's a case that they talk about, where there was a child at a sporting event in Newark, New Jersey, had a heart attack, and they thought he was just having like a seizure, and they didn't react to it, or he just passed out from dehydration. They didn't know, and he just died on the vine right in front of everybody. So it's like, you know what I mean? When you invite someone to a public space to compete, big or small event, there should be something involved on a professional level that, you know, takes care of that, or at least the people that are there, the trainers, they should be trained in CPR to be able to recognize that. Because a lot of it's just basic, you know, interventions that could save it. All they really needed to stop that at CrossFit was a guy on a board going, hey, hold on to my board. Are you done? No, I can keep going. Okay, I'm going to trail you. Good? Yeah, keep trailing. I'm not good anymore. Hold on to the board. That's it. No loss of life. It wasn't very technical. It really wasn't, sadly. So
yeah. Well, invisibility is a big thing. I worked for years in Long Lake, New York, on a summer camp there for 6 summers, and the moment the first person jumped in, all the silt from the bottom, I mean, literally, you know, as soon as they break the surface, they're gone. Yeah. And it was terrifying. We had the whole buddy system that, you know, summer camps have, and occasionally a kid would go missing. You'd be doing your search pattern, dredging the floor, you know, waiting to find a dead child. And then they come out of the wood workshop. Go, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot my tag. Okay, good. You know, but having been there, it's absolutely terrifying. And, you know, if you're used to lifeguarding in pools and now you get employed to do, you know, a lake lifeguard, well, you can't rely on being able to see the bottom. So even that's another, you know, was that someone who'd worked on lakes before and they underestimated the environment?
Yeah, I had to do, I think I told you, I consult and I train lifeguarding for some of the camps up in Pennsylvania. And it's a totally different element. But when you think about, you got all those floating docks, a kid does a backflip and gets knocked out and then he disappears. And there's a bit of a current that moves one way. It's like, it's a wholly different type of line search than it is even in the ocean. Like, you know, a gradual, like, you know, like the continental shelf of Florida, you could do like a walking search if you needed to, you know, in New Jersey, you can do the same thing. And even in Hawaii, there's ways to do it. Like in a lake, it could be 20 feet deep in the middle. You know what I mean? It's, you don't know. It's, and it's weird because you think a lake is safe, but it's not. And I think I was telling you before, New Jersey itself has more drownings, even though the beach is a problem right now, in lakes and rivers with the Delaware water gap. So it really is like, oh, we're having an event in a lake. That doesn't mean it's safe. It does not mean it's safe at all. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, another hazard that we seem to hear a lot about recently is shark attacks as well. And I know that was an event that took one of your friends' lives in Hawaii. So let's talk about that through your eyes.
Yeah. So that one's very fresh and very sad. I do have like he's a man of faith, Tamayo. He's one of my best friends. He's all of our best friends. That was the odd thing about Tamayo, is that if you talk to almost anyone that knew him for any amount of time, you're like, oh yeah, Tamayo's one of my best friends. And it's because he treated everyone like family and he was just a very good human. This is a hard one. And I talked to his wife, who's a good friend of mine too, and I just firstly, just to give that reverence and respect, like losing someone that they were so close and they're like one thing. Like they were just like an entity in itself. So then I just want to like just reiterate that it's just a great person, great relationship, just great, great couple. But with Tamayo, he was one of those guys, he wasn't going to stop doing what he was doing regardless of age and circumstances. He was still going to be surfing pipeline until he's 60 or whatever it may be. Something would need to stop him from what he was doing. And I'm not saying that it's serendipitous or it just happens, but I don't think he would have changed his ways to avoid that. He's going to live his life and things happen. And that's the surfer versus the lifeguard, right? The lifeguard is a risk technician because we're handling other people's lives. The surfer knows that this is our passion or our lifestyle. And not to be trite, but if we're so lucky to die doing what we love versus getting hit by a bus or, you know, dying of a mundane medical condition that we're all going to run into, it sucks, but it ain't the worst. It's still a tragedy that kind of like immortalizes one of the best humans I've ever known. So I do will forever miss him until we meet again, as we say, like a hui ho in Hawaii. But he went out doing what he loved at his home break. And it's like, it sucks, but it is what it is. He was an on-duty lifeguard, and there's a thing about that people don't really know, but it leads into the other side of thing with that Bill 41 that's coming out. So I'm not sure if you heard of the Ben Carlson Foundation, where Ben Carlson was on a rescue, and we don't know because it's hard to tell, but we think he got kicked by the patient underwater because he was a heck of a waterman as well.
Is that the Huntington Beach lifeguard?
Newport.
Newport,
yes.
Beach, that's right, yeah.
Newport. Yeah, they're right. They're like right next to each other. And great, you know, he surfed biggest waves too. He's a great, you know, he wasn't a professional surfer, but he was, you know, for not being a paid surfer, he was as good as anybody else. And he was a great lifeguard. Things happen. We call it the button, you know, like you get knocked out in UFC, you're on land, smelling salts, check your C-spine, you're good to go, monitor your concussion. You get knocked out in the water, gone zones. Unless you have an instant response and there's no current, you're probably a goner. And that's what happened to Ben. With Tamayo, we don't know because it was unwitnessed, but to my knowledge, he really just jumped in the water to rinse off, not even to surf, and it was gone like that. And it just wasn't witnessed. Someone found him within minutes after, but we all know how quick it is to bleed out. He lost his arm and he had a bite on his leg, so it was like two quick hits. So he could have jumped off a rock into the shark, you know, from the depths, and it came up and just hit him, thinking it was a seal or a turtle. It just happened. And unless you have a tourniquet on you, like, and even if so, can you get it on your side? It's time and circumstances. But lifeguards are not treated like other first responders. They don't have the same recognition as a designated lifeguard. And that bill is going to be introduced to Congress to have the same protections federally as a open water lifeguard that a firefighter or PD or any of the other ones do. I'm really big now that I'm not behind the lines because I'm not an active lifeguard in any agency. I'm fighting for that, for the people that are to come, because a lot of things come with that, whether it's recognition by the state, whether it's pensions, whether it's like things that, you know, dictate just standard protections. I think lifeguards need that, because it's obviously seen it's a dangerous job. You know what I mean? It's extreme. It's actually odd that there's not more on duty deaths. We're just very talented group of watermen that are operating at a very high level that know how to protect themselves. But if you took that element out and you added like a commonplace person to do that job, it would be tragedy over and over, because most people can't get themselves out of the situations that we've had to put ourselves in, let alone you on a multi-person rescue or a single person rescue in a high cert. It's difficult. So yeah, I hope that goes through. I know Fox with their, I think it's called High Cert Rescue is the show. They're using that as a catalyst to promote that bill, so people are aware and will sign on to petitions and get it moved forward, which is very nice of them, to just kind of back the lifeguards nationwide and just worldwide, really, like legitimize the profession so it's on par and recognized for what they're doing. And I hope Tamayo and I hope Ben Carlson's life are not in vain. And there's been others that have died on duty too, like Brant Vita, who had a cardiac arrest. And this is just the reality. I never was able to speak on this before because I was with the agency, but he didn't have insurance because they wouldn't give lifeguards insurance that were part-time. And he was working full-time, you know, 40 hours, but under a part-time. And then back in the 90s, he died and, you know, he was having palpitations and he didn't get checked out. And it was a huge issue. They fixed that since then. But there's just been a lot of times where we've been bastardized as an agency and a profession where it's led to deaths. And I'm just tired of it. So now that I'm not and I can speak, you know, maybe I'll piss off a few people here and there, but some things need to be said, you know?
100%. Well, it's so weird as well. Firstly, you know, when you look at lifeguards, yeah, there's a huge amount of volunteerism, but also, you know, we talked about this in the first conversation, I use you guys as an example a lot on the requirements of fitness, because in police and fire, more often than not, we're held to a standard in the academy, and that's it for the rest of your career, fucking insane. Whereas even as a pool/lake lifeguard, if I didn't pass all my tests, my quals, then I'm not a lifeguard anymore. I don't have the cert anymore. So, you know, so that, you know, puts us absolutely shoulder to shoulder. I mean, I have a huge amount of respect for ocean lifeguards because I didn't lifeguard an ocean and, you know, pools.
It was hard enough just to do the Red Cross cert. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, I personally think accountability in any first response, but that's just my mentality, is I think it shouldn't just be us. I think we all should be held to a standard. You know, you have to make accommodations maybe throughout the career for what level you're at, whether you're a lieutenant, if you're a desk jockey, if you've moved into different admin positions, yes, there should be exemptions. But if you're an active field officer as a PD or a firefighter, your job is intense. Ocean lifeguarding is extremely intense. We kind of need those standards. It does put a strain on the guys. Like, I'm 42 and I've kept that idle high on my engine. So my goal is to, even though I'm not active, to be able to do that test every year and keep it within a, you know, a 10% range of when I started until I would have retired at 56, just because it's my own mentality. But I know everyone doesn't have that, but I think it should be. I think it really should be, because you're signing up for something that involves other people's lives, and it's a disrespect to the profession if you just going to sandbag and let, you know, just let it fly by the night, see if it's just going to work out. You know, I don't think that's good.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a thing I do every year called the 343 Hero Challenge, run by some of my friends in Orange County. Amazing competition, but they have a master's division, which I think is 40 and above. And I've always partnered up with one of the younger firefighters, because exactly what you said, that's great that there's that division, but I'm a firefighter, and so I hold myself, you know, accountable to be able to do what the 20 and 30 year olds can do. It's not showing off. It's just, well, you know, if I'm going to sit here behind a microphone and preach fitness and, you know, responsibility and ownership, then I need to bloody walk the walk as well.
There's two things from that. One, I want to pick your brain on the 343, because I'm doing a professional lifeguard tournament through the nonprofit to raise money, but also give professionals prize money. With the Waterman's Challenge, and we did a demo this year and it worked out really good. We're changing it, the aspect of lifeguard competitions from like dory boats, which is cool, to just run, swim, runs. I want to make it a progression based race. So run, swim, paddle, C-spine package, run, swim, run, CPR all the way to BVM to packaging, jet ski time trials through a course with a human pickup. Efficiently, if you injure them during the process or would have by the judges saying, hey, that was a fail, then you can't pass. You have to go fast, but you have to be accurate. So it's not just the physicality, because lifeguarding is very physical, but it's like they say, is like slow is smooth and smooth is fast. You have to do things accurately in lifeguarding to have success for the patient to get on the beach safely without further injury of their back, neck, medical, bleeding control, C-spining, packaging. The whole nine has to be done within that physical element as well. And I want to showcase that because then people have an actual idea of what we do. If you can showcase that as like a professional event, showing what actually happens when we have to put it all on the line and we don't have a pause button, because you start a rescue. There's no like, let's stop here and wait. It doesn't work like that. The wave hits you when the wave hits you. The accident happens. It's all linear. So that's one thing. I have had captains too that even though they're not required to do the test, they do the run swim every year just to show unity. And I appreciate that, because if I was still in lifeguarding and I ended up getting to that position of chief or a captain anywhere, I would still do it, because I think if you can't at least show camaraderie and attempt to be a part of your force, and like it's not good leadership. So I appreciate when I see things happen like that.
Absolutely. Well, talking again about the professional side, this is one thing that's been really strange to me, and ironically where you are now, there, this is where it's rife, is the volunteer fire service in super densely populated suburban areas in the Northeast, and this is kind of deviation from, the hierarchy of needs. Like, safety and security is the absolute first level. So whether it's your beaches or your streets, to rely on volunteerism, and volunteerism is admirable.
It's super admirable. Yeah. But yeah, I agree. So where I live, it's super prevalent, and I want to be very eggshelly with this, because I don't want to ever offend, because I'm an EMT volunteer in my town, like if they need me, but they also have a professional service, so they pick up the backup calls. Like, say if there's three things going on at once, great, you get a page, you get a call, go. Fire, they have 12-hour services. They cut off at 6 p.m. here, and I very strangely go like, well, wouldn't most fires happen around dinner time when the fires are going on in the house, or when, they don't happen, like fires happen when they happen. So, but it's no fault of their own. It's just one of those things. There's a transition. Now, the culture of volunteer firefighting is amazing. It's cool that people want to do that. But the reality is that the economics of it these days is people in these areas, they've gotten way more expensive to live. So they can't just drop their job and go on a call, or there's less attraction to being a volunteer because they have to work the job that requires the money to live in these densely populated, expensive shore towns. And they're still running off volunteer service, which I think there should always be volunteer service, but they should also have a line of professionalism to man the firehouses throughout, no matter what. And then the backup staff will rotate. And that's a good way to get them in to kind of cultivate the next class of professionals, is maybe you do 5 years of volunteer and back up the crew, and then go from there. That could be a good way to transition. But it's like anything, small town, big town, oversight. They don't like the state fights with the town fights with the state. And then at the end of the day, the only thing that really gets the short end of the stick is the house that burns down. You know what I mean? Because there wasn't any volunteers available for that, for that call or something like that. So it's a hard one. I wish everyone the best on that. I've got fire extinguishers all over my house for that reason, because you never know. It's like, hopefully they come, but who knows?
Well, I think, priority, there's a lot of departments that are, running a lot of calls that are volunteers that should just be made professional. There's no question, if you're in a densely populated high tax area and then you haven't allocated funds for a fire service, then you should. And I think it's the same with the lifeguarding community. And of course, there are exceptions to all these rules. If you're in a rural place where a population of 250, I get the volunteer fire service completely.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And that's where it started in New Jersey, because these towns were shore towns and, they're 1 square mile or 2 square miles and there's like maybe 500 people. But now it's not like that. It's like sprawl, and there's 150,000 people living in the area. It's different, So things change. It's the way it goes.
Well, speaking of Ben, I went to have breakfast with one of my friends in Newport Beach, and there's a statue of him on the beach there. But again, I think a lot of those were volunteers as well. And so when you think about such an affluent, densely populated area as Newport and Huntington, and further out, there should be professionally paid lifeguards. And again, if someone assaults a lifeguard, that should have the same penalty if they assault a firefighter or a cop.
Yeah. I think in Hawaii, we were able to get that, because sadly, everything happens at the beach in Hawaii. So like the good and the bad, right? So you're going to get the local, you know, meth head freaking out, and that's going to happen at the beach. You're going to have to. So the salt thing, we did get protection, I think about like 8 years ago. When it comes to Newport and California, they do a pretty good job of cultivating summertime and full-time hires. You have to do a few seasons because they get paid pretty well in California. They're the litmus. LA, Newport, Orange County, you know, you could make $100,000 as a lifeguard, like as a, you know, even maybe not even as a lieutenant, which, but it's hard to get that position. There's a lot of low paid $16 an hour summer hires that do a lot of the heavy lifting. In New Jersey, they're 99% summer hires with a couple admin staff. The difference in California and Hawaii is that there's a lot of regulation on training, and their SOPs, like in Huntington and Newport, are just like, and LA too, just great. And I will say, and Honolulu has come a long way in the last 5 years about really getting professional, because we have the best watermen, but sometimes we just didn't have the assets to the back end. Now we're getting there, and I'm very, very appreciative to see all the hard work that went into that. New Jersey, because local government, it's town by town, and they do a good job, and the lifeguards as a whole really mean well. The problem is that the standardization of one lifeguard agency for another isn't there. So there's no state regulation, like you'd have a fire, you know, oversight come down, commissioner, and go look at the firehouse and check everything and check the hoses and do everything, or give like check your EAPs and everything. There isn't that. The way it works is that you submit, you're a member of the national board, which is USLA, but they're not a training organization. They're just an organization for lifeguarding for the US. So they do a great job. They run amazing tournaments. They have a good manual, but that manual applies as a general overview. It's not how you do things in your specific area. I'd like to see New Jersey, because the coastline of New Jersey essentially, and a lot like Florida, it's the same coastline for 60 miles, right? So the only thing dividing it is a tax map key and maybe a jetty, if that. So the beach is the beach. The way to do, you know, the winds are north, the currents are going this way. The winds are south, the currents are going that way. There's a jetty here, there's an entry point. It's very similar, but you'll see a beach down south running a different rescue module and not using rescue boards. And then you'll see a surf community that's really good with surfboards running a, you know, like a rescue board protocol and a jet ski. And then you won't have a jet ski in this town, but it's the same rip current. It's the same people. It's the same tourists. It's the same type of locals. And the problem with that is, one, is the standard is in equal parts, because yeah, maybe they have a different talent pool. Some of these agencies have like as good as lifeguards I've ever seen. Some of them are getting, you know, inland and other places because they're just trying to put it together. And I think they did a really good job. They started a lifeguard academy. Seagirt in New Jersey, one of the more forward-thinking agencies, they started this initiative to start a lifeguard academy, and it's a really good start, so I'm very proud of them. Tim Harmon is actually the chief there, and his brother, and the whole staff does a really good job. They were very forward-thinking. They did a jet ski course with the Big Wave Assessment Group and us this year, and I got to guest train, and some cool things are happening. I do think, and personally, and it's, this is what I think, is that that academy should be for the whole state, and there should be all the way through. And I think that the emergency action plans, SOPs, and protocols should be standardized. And there's two reasons for that. One is patient care. So that way the beach is the beach in New Jersey. We all know what we're up against. And then secondly, liability, because limited liability for the lifeguard. If they have a training standard, and then something goes south because heavy surf conditions or something goes wrong, as long as it's not gross negligence, they would be protected because they followed a protocol that is transparent across the board and works. It's not like we do a line pull here and we use dory boats here, or we use rescue boards in this and we use jet skis here. It's, this is your situation, you need to have as your minimum standards. And if you don't have this, there should be state funds that go fund your jet ski program, and we'll send a team down to do that, or send you up to the academy to run through that. Because when it really comes down to it is, if a guy gets rescued up in Monmouth County by a jet ski on a boating accident or some other type of multi-person rescue, and then the same thing happens, say, in you know, Wildwood, New Jersey, and they don't have a jet ski program, not picking on you, Wildwood, I'm just making an assumption that you may or may not, just any town farther away doesn't have it. Well, the patient is the one who suffers, and you're going to be on the hook, you know, and you're actually going to be on the hook because there was nothing iterated of like, well, they do this up here and it worked, and you did this down there and it didn't work, so obviously you're negligible. So that's why it's a win-win for both sides. It's a win-win for the agencies. It's a win-win for the patient care. And I don't see any downsides to it. So I'm really pushing for it.
What about recruitment? Police, fire, EMS, we're all struggling a lot. And you know, there's many things I talk about as far as fixing the things that are deterring young applicants to get them testing for us again, lining up out the door, and then retaining a lot of the people that are experienced that are retiring early because of the working conditions. What are you seeing in the lifeguarding community?
New Jersey is a bit different because I would say the lion's share of the vets come from the teaching profession because they end right after Memorial Day and they can jump on the beach and they've got really good experience and they're solid watermen. They've been doing it since they've been 16. But to fill in the gaps, and then when the college kids goes back, so they all go to skeleton crews. So that's when we get the surf. Like this last week was like 8-foot surf for 4 days, a really good hurricane swell. I don't know if you saw that storm. And they're half staffed or less. So there's just towers dropping and stands dropping. And it's like, you can only red flag so much at the beach. Things are going to get, it's just the way it goes. And I have a whole thing with that too, is that like red flagging a beach where you're paying high taxes and beach badges is, you know, like maybe the state should fund some professionals to do this, you know, year round so they can cover that. So they're not just a 4-month salary. So that way they actually have, just like California does, you have seasonals and you have full timers, and the full timers run that beach and they respond to rescues in the middle of winter. It doesn't matter. They're ready to go. You know what I mean? That's where I want to come with that. But they just, in general, what I think has happened is that lifeguarding used to be like a rite of passage in the Northeast. Whereas if you were surf adjacent, a swimmer, a lifeguard, a firefighter, or any of the, or you wanted to go to those things, or if you were, you know, just like a college athlete and you wanted to stay fit, you became a lifeguard and everyone did a season or two lifeguarding. People are finding other jobs or not working anymore in these areas, the young kids. So that's the hard part, is finding the seasonals. There is good ones and there's a lot of them that are putting out there, but you need thousands of lifeguards here. Like we have 300 in Hawaii. You need probably 5,000 lifeguards from Cape May to Sandy Hook. I think maybe more actually. You might just run rotational basis. So there's got to be fostering programs, and that's what Never Off Duty was, essentially, is to fix that lifeguard shortage in like an incubator. Get them into the water park, get them a base, get them trained up to do the beach, stage it up, let them run through their college career, and then maybe they work during the summer on weekends, or they work if they're teachers through the whole summer. So there's ways to do it, but you need a lot of public awareness that it is a gap, and you really need to like get these kids back into the cultural aspect of being a lifeguard from, you know, Maine all the way down to Delaware. Like that was a thing, I know for a fact, because we're all kind of living in the same beach towns, and it's just there's less of that. So I'm hoping that we can kind of start promoting it again and there's some hype to it again.
Well, you talked about Never Off Duty before. Give us an overview again, and then what's been the progress the last few years?
Yeah, so Hawaii is going great. I have my board in Hawaii. They've done awesome things. We've got 1,000 people through the program over the last almost 6 years since we started in 2017. Base level American Red Cross pool and waterfront lifeguarding, starting in jobs, then moving into the Never Off Duty open water program to get them ready for ocean safety tryouts. So now they do both. Now that we have the curriculum up and running. We wrote that curriculum actually for the State Department because we were going to do sports envoys as a economic driver in different international coastal communities that have beach towns that don't have lifeguarding, like creating a lifeguard agency for those hotel areas. So that way it's an economic driver for safe beaches for those, like say Indonesia, Sri Lanka. And that's where I wrote that program for, but now I've adapted it so that way people can use it as a general program, and we put all our kids through it. So that way they're ready to go on the beach and there's some type of standardization. We started a chapter in New Jersey with the Waterman's Ball this year. Went great. Most of the money is going to go to education, elementary school education, water safety. We have that Barefoot Brigade book, so we're going to print another 10,000 copies, hopefully more, do another 15 schools, and then kind of build it from there and get funding. And then we're going to hire a grant writer for this region because it has to be state by state, and we can't commingle funds. So like I can't pull from Hawaii to start New Jersey. So I had to do the same thing as I did in Hawaii, whereas I put in my own capital. People see the value in it. We get chairs and we get people involved just as a regular nonprofit, and they fundraise, and then we can go on from there and start, you know, working the ways to keep revenue coming into it and revenue going out of it to create the programs and facilitate the program. So it's a little bit easier this time because it was like a 2-year gap from me starting it in Hawaii to any type of success, because it was my own, you know, bootstrapping. And at that time in Hawaii, Jersey Mike's oddly got involved, and they did a month of giving and got us through the next hurdle. Whereas here, we did a Waterman's Ball and that lifeguard tournament to fundraise, and it went good. And we started off with a $24,000 raise. Luke Shepherdson gave me a signed board from his quiver. He was the Eddie Aikau winner, and that went to $13,000. Went for $13,000, which is going to cover a lot of the books and the staffers to go to these schools and teach the water safety right before summertime and spring. So we're getting there for sure. We got a lot of lofty goals, but we're getting there.
Brilliant. Well, talk to me about the education you're doing in our schools. And obviously here in Florida, there are a huge amount of pools. A lot of our first responders go to numerous drownings, and it's definitely one of the most traumatic events that we respond to. So what do you suggest as far as a new parent? And we're talking about the infants, and then let's talk about, if not that, then what about elementary school?
Yeah, so elementary, I think, is the first place they can conceptualize. So obviously, if you have a child, like I taught my kid to swim because I'm a lifeguard, so I did it myself, but not everybody has those resources. So some people don't even have access to pools to teach swim lessons. Like, and that was one of the things, is we wanted to have funds to rent out pools in the wintertime for free swim lessons. So that's a base layer. In the elementary schools, we wanted to give visual examples with the book, and then teaching what a riptide is, teaching what buddy swimming is, teaching what, how to check in with a lifeguard, why you would. You know, all the things that, you know, as lifeguards, we teach our kids, but, you know, you move 10 minutes west of where I am, and that might not even be a thought. You know, they're either in rural or they're in urban, and both of those have the same issue where they're just, you know, they're not coastal, but then they come to the coast in the summer, and they all do, or they go to the water park in the summer, and it's education. So sometimes if the parent doesn't have the knowledge, they don't pass it on. We want to be that stopgap, so that stops. And then when we teach the kid, when they have kids, they're going to teach the same lessons, and that's a base. And then they might not become lifeguards later, but maybe 1 out of 100 do. And if we, you know, say we extrapolate that out and we get through 200,000 kids in New Jersey, and you get 20,000 lifeguards off that over, you know what I mean? It's all a numbers game, but we're prevention, because education is prevention. Then two, we can facilitate and incubate the jobs training from there. So we have a system on how to do it. We just needed some ammo and some fuel to get behind it to implement it. And it's starting to get there for sure.
I was very lucky. The junior school I went to in England, every Wednesday we would go swimming. So
yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I think I started there at 3 years old. So I can't remember if we went that early. I'm not sure, but certainly that's my entire memory. And then as you get older, you start working for, you know, your 25 meter badge, your 50 meter badge, and you're working towards a mile.
It's great.
Yeah, phenomenal program. And then you're doing the whole, you know, get your pajamas, tie the legs together.
Learn how to surf, swim survival. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So again, when we talk about environment, you know, I always say this when we talk about my health and fitness. I grew up on a farm in England. A lot of the environment set me up for success in that. And I think it's the same. If you buy an ocean or you have access to a pool, you know, there's a high chance that you're going to get more exposure to be able to swim.
Exactly.
That being said, prior to any sort of schooling at all, obviously there are those programs where we see these little infants being flung into a pool and they go on their back and they kick their way out, which I couldn't swim at that age.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that element. It's not up to the child, of course, now we're talking to the parents, but what is the efficacy and the importance of doing it that young?
Yeah, so I think it is, because pool drownings just irk me. It stinks, but it happens. I know people that have, I know personal people that have lost children that way, and they're water people, because the pool doesn't have the scary element of the ocean. The ocean kind of keeps kids at bay at certain times, but a pool, you can run into someone's backyard at a birthday party and just drown. And I actually know someone that saved his own child just doing a scan and noticed something at the bottom of the pool, and it ended up being his kid, and he resuscitated him. Luckily, he had the lifeguard eye. But we're not excluded from that as lifeguards. It can happen to any parent, especially just young children. And it's a tragedy regardless. Something that I hate to see is that, like, in the oranges and the outside surrounding parts of Newark and different urban areas, some of the pools have been shut down from basic needs of, like, say, a pump being fixed or, like, the funding for chlorine, and then they shut the whole pool down for a whole summer. That's a whole generation that lost their swimming ability that could have had programs. So I would love to get this to the point where we go, hey, what's your need? Okay, so, you know, the private element isn't working. How can we publicly fund that and grant you the 10 grand to fix your pool pumps or to hire your guards or to hire WSI swim lessons? Like, let's figure that out, because that's downstream. Someone's going to drown because of that situation. So another thing is foresight of the parent. If the parent's not a swimmer regardless of your social economic, just not a swimmer, you might not even think about it because it's not on your radar. We're going to go to the baseball field. We're going to go, but then your kid goes to a birthday party or he ends up at the beach for the first time on a field trip and something goes wrong, whatever it may be. Those situations come up all the time. We're trying to like get as much awareness to the need, then fix it with the education. And then from there, foster that education and turn it into actually skills. So that's, we got to start from the base. Like I was like, oh, let's get everyone on life. It's getting someone to a high standard of lifeguard will take a long time, but preventing a drowning is actually pretty simple. So we were kind of like, let's scale it back and start where, hey, you need a swimsuit. Let's get you a swimsuit. You need to find a free swimming and, you know, water safety course. Let's get you into one. Let's find you funding for that. You know, so that's where we actually brought the programming down to a very base level. I think that's going to like actually scale the whole program up.
Absolutely. Well, before we hit record, you were showing me a bag. So let's go back to sharks first, because obviously that's, you know, the bleeding control on the beach. What is your community seeing about the prevalence of shark attacks? Because sometimes it gets skewed when something makes the news and all of a sudden, you know, they're reporting everything and maybe it was going on the whole time. What are you actually seeing, though, as far as stats first? And then let's talk about the equipment that our lifeguards need to be carrying.
Sure. So a prevalent shark population shows the health of the ocean. So it's not a negative thing. Friend just got chased out 2 days ago in Asbury Park from a shark. I don't know if you've seen in New Jersey, but the whales have come back, the rays have come back, the dolphins have come. The nature in New Jersey is actually pretty wonderful. You know, they had the stigma in the 80s of the needles and the red tide and all this stuff. That's gone. They've done a very good job of management here. And we're getting like some of the cool stuff I've seen in Hawaii, I'm seeing here, like, which is pretty cool. But with that, nature is nature and it is what it is. So shark attacks, you know, very unlikely, but they do happen. I think just as prevalent is surf and water safety accidents. So we had a friend in Indonesia that died of a bleeding control incident. His fin caught his femoral artery and he bled out very quickly. There was nothing to do because transport was 6 hours and the mentalized and things of that nature. You know, not even big surf, world-class surfer McCullough Jones passes away, you know, very tragically from a bleeding control situation that maybe on the mainland here in Hawaii could have been aided there, it couldn't, but that can happen here too. So I do produce these kits. I give them as presents to people. I've done it for years. I did it as like a side project to bring in revenue. Maybe we'll sell a kit and like a Tom shoe, you know, buy one, give one. But I just started giving them out. I had extra funds and, you know, I put them together. And then this company called StatPak, I've been working with them for like 3 years on and off, just trying to like develop products. They gave me a few kits for myself when I was an EMT and just doing my own stuff. They just kind of supported me. Just cool guys, like really cool company. They come from the backpack world. And I made a hip pack that this is the first iteration. So that way people could keep it on as lifeguards or keep it in your car, throw it in a travel bag, but just a very useful go-to. And just to kind of answer your question, though, are sharks being more prevalent? Yeah, that's a fact. Because I did an article on it once for Vice Sports, the bro science of shark attacks and surfing, and you can look it up. And I went through the numbers and it is increasing. It just is. That could be population density. That could be usage of the surf. But if you look at like Cape Cod, like the seal population and the documentaries, yeah, the sharks are back and that's a good thing. But, you know, people plus hazards equal risk, and the hazard's the shark and the people are there. It's going to happen. So, you know, in New Smyrna, Florida, you get bumped every day. So it just all depends on where you are surfing and that kind of thing. This is the kit that we were talking about before. This is the first iteration. It probably won't be the last. We're going to do a couple more tweaks to it, but it's basically, it's got the Velcro so you could rip off a tourniquet. I just have my pen light there for concussions and stuff. This has got a pouch here. So like Israeli bandage, all your gauze, your gloves, all your go-to stuff. Maybe an OPA, something of that nature. You could stack right here, so your OPAs, your oropharyngeal airways, and just like your adjuncts can be in the front. Quick stuff that you need, like on the fly. I throw like for travel. I'll throw like a Closex because I actually hurt my knee the other week surfing where I just tore it open on a rock. So instead of, you know, that's just me. Not I don't recommend anyone else doing this, but I closed it up so I didn't have to get sutured. I just did it myself and just ran a bead of quick clot and a Closex and stitch it up myself so I could surf again the next swell. But just something that you could throw in your bag and go travel to Nicaragua, or you could just have in your car for a car accident, and also wear as a hip pack as a lifeguard, like an interchangeable fanny pack that's like an everyday carry. And StatPak looks to release that this fall into next spring, and they're going to give 5% of sale to the Never Off Duty Foundation for that water safety program. So it's pretty cool that they got involved that way. And they actually already sell to a lot of the agencies as well. So it's a good thing for us.
Brilliant. One more question before we go to the closing questions. I had an amazing experience. I was with my son a few weeks ago, and I was at Crescent Beach, which is south of St. Augustine, my favorite beach on the planet. It's gorgeous. And there was a pod of dolphin, and they were just around me. And, you know, so I was out there. No, hardly anyone else sat in the water. I was a little bit deeper because I like to body surf. And just standing in awe as these beautiful creatures were around. Which was amazing. My sister is an editor, and she works a lot with the wildlife and David Attenborough, and does all that TV for the BBC. And she was like, "Oh, you know, they could have been protecting you from sharks."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, okay. So maybe if I'd seen behind the dolphin, I would have fucking run my ass out." But that being said, though, I mean, you know, again, I think nature is amazing, and you know, it is what it is. Yeah. If that happens, I wouldn't enjoy it.
Two opposing teams: the sharks versus the dolphins. Yeah,
exactly.
The dolphins do a good job of because the sharks will try to attack the babies, right? So they're used to just going head to head and just straight, they'll just nail them in the guts, you know what I mean? And just try to take them out when they see them. But they also they're pretty cool with people. That's why I get really frustrated when I see like blackfish and all the stuff that you see with the culling of dolphins for food. I'm like, those guys are cool with us. We should be nicer to them. They like us. Be a little kinder. They're smart, you know?
Well, with the profile of a human in the water, are there any, whether it's kind of folklore in Hawaii or maybe some of the science stuff, what can a human being swimming in the ocean do to minimize the chance of being confused for prey? Because, I mean, clearly if you are a surfer and you're paddling on a wave, looking up, you know, that seems like it might have the same kind of silhouette as a seal. Yep. So that, you know, is going to be a higher target. But for your average swimmer, you know, what are some of the things that are told in Hawaii to kind of maybe try and help reduce that risk?
I did just see, because I'm still on group chats with all my lifeguard buddies, shark bands donated bands to the guards on the North Shore anyway. They just, you know, just nicely gave to them. I think they work. I don't know, because I don't know. I know it's a frequency, but it seems like it does. So I'd look into that if that's a concern, something to do. I'm not endorsed by them. I don't know the validity, but that was really sweet of them to reach out and, you know, keep us another element of safety. I would say strength in numbers. One thing I noticed, I have my friend Colin Cook. He got bit, and he was my neighbor, and his leg was taken off at the North Shore right near our house. And he luckily was saved by another friend, Keone Borthup, that uses surf leash as a makeshift tourniquet so he could get, you know, out of the water. It was a crazy rescue. Never heard of anything like that, really. It was just such a wild scenario where the shark actually kept chasing him. Seasonally, we get these adolescent sharks in Hawaii that will follow their migratory pattern and usually find lakes and not lakes and rivers, but just rivers. They feed off rivers because the outflow. So where he got bit was near an old river. So sometimes it's not best to surf near rivers. Because of that fact, because they know where the fish come out, right? You know, like that's usually the brackish water is a good place to hunt. One thing, and I've heard from multiple different people that study them, is that movement is good. So if you're surfing, sitting on your board for long periods of time, even though it's fun and nice to relax, it shows that you're like dead weight and you're an easy target. So sometimes when there's no movement and you look like a turtle hanging over your board, you could be an already dead animal that they just want to, like a dead whale, they go after a dead turtle. So they'll check bite that just to see what it is. And when they find out it's not you, most of the time they'll just go, but you've already had the life altering bite, depending on the size, if it's a bull shark or tiger or white, you know what I mean? It's the damage has been done. So I like me personally, I just stay active in the water. I'm never not. I would never say that it's hard not to surf alone, because us as surfers, we're trying to avoid crowds, but it's good to have an emergency action plan, like someone on the beach knowing where you are. I actually didn't take my own advice the other day. The waves were so good and the winds went back offshore in New Jersey, and I was after work, so I jumped in before dark and I was like, where is everybody? And I'm surfing by myself and started to get the heebie-jeebies. And one of those things I will say is, if your intuition is off, get out. Because you have a lot more senses when you're in the elements than you think you do, especially when you're in like a very contained space of nature. Your instincts start kicking in, and you see a splash, you see something in the water, you feel something weird, You know what I mean? Your body picks on stuff that your brain doesn't even know yet. So it might be worth getting out and checking just to make sure everything's right. You see birds hitting fish right near you. You know, little fish. Big fish follows the little fish. Just be aware. You know what I mean? Like, there's things that are preventable by just by understanding what's going on around you. But again, though, like, sometimes time and circumstances, like, it's happened to multiple people that I know and they weren't doing anything wrong. It just happens. You know, like, my friend passed, my other friend lost his leg. I know multiple people that are just like, I actually know them. It's not that I've heard of them. I actually know them. So it's like, it can happen. You know what I mean? I've only been bumped in Florida of all places. I was surfing in Palm Beach, about mid center between Reef Road and then like, say like the Bath and Tennis, there's like the Mar-a-Lago area all over there. I found like an outside spot when I was like 19. I was lifeguarding down there to make some money in I think it was sardines. I'm not too sure, so long ago, but there was a run of fish and the pile went through me and a bull shark just hit me, like physically hit me on my leg. And I had already thought I was bit and I literally sprint paddled like 200 yards back to shore, still thinking I got hit, not looking because I knew I had to get back. And when I got back, I just had a big welt and the thing didn't have its jaws open. It's just the body hit me so hard. So I was like, yeah, I had that adrenaline spike of like, I was not calm and cool. I was, you know, shit in a brick, to be honest with you. It's a scary thing.
I had a bizarre impact body surfing a while ago, and I had this strange, there was a bruise, there was a graze, but it was like the pain I've never felt before. I never thought about that. What if I actually got bumped? Probably not. I was quite shallow.
But aren't really big. They're just aggressive. You know what I mean? Like, Makos usually will leave you alone. Hammerheads will usually, the bulls in Florida, like, that scares me. That new Smyrna thing, the whole, like, there's 100 guys surfing. I'm looking at them. They're crazier than the guys that surf pipe, because I'm like, I surfed it once and you can have it. I'm good.
All right. Well, you mentioned Barefoot Brigade. So I want to talk about where to find everything that you do first. But what about other books? Are there books that you love to recommend to people?
I just bought my daughter The Talent Code. I've read it before. Talent Code's, I forgot the author. I'm just blanking right now. So she's reading that. And I got her Soul Surfer, which was Bethany Hamilton's book, even though it's been out for a while. She knows Bethany. And I was like, you should read this. Like, motivational. She's kind of a hero. Like, she's a cool person. The family, friends with all the family, but she's a great person. Talent Code is cool because it shows how, like, time and effort actually dictate success versus talent. It's not always talent. It's like generic skills, but then refined and just persistence actually trumps everything. I'm actually writing my second book. My first one was a novel that I did for, I think I told you why I wrote that book originally, is I had a bad concussion and I used it as a way to reorganize my brain and my structure. So I wrote the novel so I could have like a more of a goal, but this one is totally different. The working title is Come Hell or High Water. And it's basically the story of, it's basically an autobiography, but it's how I've built skills over time to deal with stress that I think could help other people. And I am going to use that hopefully to launch the funding for my wife's nonprofit. I want to use the funding that comes from that book to help people stress manage, understand, like, we all deal with some heavy circumstances. There's ways to mitigate it. It's not always perfect, but you can do it. But she wants to fund a study. She's a biologist scientist, and she also is a scent detection specialist with canines. And we would like to work with canines to do early detection for neuroblastoma specifically. So that way, young children that, you know, with between urinalysis and saliva, they could pick up, because they can do this with other cancers, specifically for neuroblastoma, has never been done. So we want to work with different hospitals and get samples from willing participants to see if the dogs can pick up on this for early detection, because there really is no early detection. It's like you walk in with inflammation and then all of a sudden you're thrust into the craziest scenario of your life and you're stage four, versus as if, you know, like, you know, because you're not going to just arbitrarily give a 2-year-old an MRI or a CAT scan and the radiation and all that extra stuff that you don't want to do. You need it at one point, but if there's a way to kind of go like preemptively find these neuroblastoma cells and through, you know, very simple methods of a canine's nose, we want to see proof of concept. We think it can work and we want to figure out funding for that. And it's not cheap. So I'm going to write this book altruistically to give people stress management tools, but then use it as a catalyst to help more people on the back end that are dealing with what we dealt with. So look out for that. I'm going to try to get it done in the next 6 months. We'll see if I can do it.
Amazing. I just finished my second one. So yeah, it's a fight, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a fight. Yeah, exactly. And when I had my daughter was an infant when I wrote my first one. So I'd write during naps. It's like, okay, I got 2 hours. Now I got two kids. I'm like, okay, I might be talking to my phone and then refining it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's gonna be a trip, but it's a goal. So I'll get it done.
Brilliant. Yeah. You talked about Bethany Hamilton. My son was reading Soul Surfer. I think he was around the same age, about 10, because maybe a little bit older. But anyway, she came on, we were doing the Zoom call, and he came in and talked to her for a few minutes. And I literally became the world's coolest dad after that, because
introduced
her. But I need to get her back on. I know, you know, her perspective, even of the pandemic was a very powerful one.
I haven't listened to that. I got to check it out. That'd be cool.
Yeah, she was amazing.
She's a great person. She's a really good person.
She is. And again, just seeing, I mean, you see this in a documentary as well, but not only coming back as an adaptive athlete, but going like, no, I'm just going to go surf with everyone else again. And, you know, just tow me into that God knows how big wave, and I'll just do it with one arm. Really?
Chopra. Yeah. So her brother and then Matahi, was a Tahitian surfer, was her safety. In the dark, she packed a 12 footer that the footage couldn't even pick up because it was so gray, and she just did it for her own pride. And like a 12-foot wave of Chopra, you saw that like with Gabriel Mendia, it was the same size wave and she went for it. And then if you look in Fiji, she actually competed and she won some heats, which is like, it's mind-blowing. Like it's absolutely mind-blowing. She's a champ.
She really is. Well, speaking of you know, the film side, what about films and documentaries? Any of those that you love?
Films, I always go, it's probably because I haven't had time to find much new, but Gattaca was always my go-to when I was a kid. Because I'm not very gifted, I'm athletic, but I'm on a scale of like a 10, I'm probably like a 5 or a 6. I'm not like a freak athlete, but I'm pretty knuckleheaded where you tell me I can't do something. And that storyline was all about like someone who had got all the genetics just gifted to him through a gene line and designer baby versus brother who didn't have any of that, was myopic, had like eye issues, had physical issues, had asthma, had all these issues, but he always beat his brother in swim races. And that was like their challenge. And his brother couldn't figure out how, like he's just better, he's built better. And he was, I never saved anything for the swim back. Like, it's like, it's just show it, like the concept is like, if you give your all, you're going to beat someone that has just like this natural ability because they're going to give up by will. And if your will's stronger, you can do a lot more with it. So I still go back to that. There's a lot of other, you know, really cool things I've seen lately. But yeah, that's the one I always go to.
Brilliant. Now, you recommended last time we spoke, when I asked about guest suggestions, it was Peter Conroy who came on, and then Craig Davison, I think, was your recommendation too, who had, was amazing. And obviously a fellow stuntman too. So asking the same question now, is there a person you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
I'm trying to think. So Brian Kailana is always at the top of my list. He's usually busy with production, so you never know. But I know he might have a gap now between shooting because he's an amazing person. He got offered to be the captain of Ocean Safety on the West Side, and he was very deserving of it. He already was essentially the captain in everyone's mind at that time. He designed a lot of programs with my uncle, like we call him uncles there, but like Terry Ahui, they designed the jet ski program. And then he moved during Waterworld into the water safety. And he's went all the way from being like a stunt coordinator and a rigger all the way on to directing. Now he's directing this show. So to see someone that can win in one playing field, move all the way into another playing field, and then operate at the highest level, it's pretty amazing. And his son is following in his footsteps and doing very cool stuff as well. So Brian is just, he's exceptional. He's actually the main thing about all the Kailanas. They're family friends at this point. Nolan, his nephews, they're all, and Keone and all the guys there, and Brandon, they're all family to me. But him is like kind of the patriarch of that family. And with his dad, Buffalo Kailana, who is a legend as well, the first lifeguard at Makaha, that family just has, they're so dynamic and so many things they do that you could just pick their brain about. Like I call like Nolan, he's like, you know, like the, in case of emergency, break glass. Like they have genius. The family has genius in elements where most people don't even like know. Like the guy, Nolan was on a trip with the Hokulea from Tahiti to Hawaii and their desalinization machine broke. And you can't drink water on a sailboat in the middle of the Pacific. You're going to die. He took it apart, put it back together, and just figured it out. You know what I mean? And it's like, he might not be your guy you want doing your HR and your IT at some company, but it, when the S hits the F, like, those guys know how to figure it out. And they're like, they've been extremely influential in my life, because the things that I give credence to of skills that I wanted to learn and I didn't have, I could go to them and kind of just shadow. And they're all about giving away the knowledge for free as far as water safety. So that's where NOD came from, is like, I want to perpetuate that. I never want to like have something that I could help someone with and like put it behind a paywall. They've never done that. They just go like, yeah, if you need it, we got it. And I think they're extremely admirable for that. And same with Terry, who is very cut from the same cloth kind of thing.
Brilliant. Yeah, Brian, I think Craig and his wife were trying to help me connect with him. I did have his number, but I hadn't probably reaching out at the wrong time. So I need to circle around and revisit that.
And I got a really good guy in New Jersey too, Matt Giacetti. He owns he was a former lifeguard. He's a medic. And he is helping with this Fox thing to promote that Bill 41. He has a company called Life Force, another training organization, but he's very passionate about life saving and lifeguarding, EMT. He's seen a lot of stuff. You know what I mean? Like, because I was an EMT when I first came back to New Jersey to get my family going. And I will say, it's out of all the things I've seen in fires, probably, but on the volume that EMT see, one, they're way underpaid. Two, the stress management, the lifestyle is totally different. I give it up to EMTs because they see it all and it's pretty heavy. And he's, you know, still involved in lifeguarding, but he's very medically sound with all the experience he has. And he's just a good guy to talk to just about, you know, first response in general.
Brilliant. I'd love to connect with him as well then.
Great. I'll put you two together.
Awesome. Thank you. All right. Well, then the very last question before we make sure where everyone knows where to find your books and your projects, what do you do to decompress?
Jiu-jitsu and surfing. Yeah, mainly. I train every day, no matter what. Like, I don't care what's going on. If I have 20 minutes, I'm working out, just because it puts me at like an even keel. But jiu-jitsu, I think, is something that more first responders should do, just because it's moving meditation. You can't do two things at once. Not everyone has access to surfing, but these days everyone can, you know, train in grappling and jiu-jitsu. And for a guy like me, it's like one of those things is like, one, we got to get rid of our ego a lot. And it's the greatest way to humble yourself, because you're never going to be the guy in every room. It's just impossible. And the levels are just so, there's so many levels to it that it's just like, I'm never going to quit jiu-jitsu, because it's just, even if I'm the old man at 70, just like, you know, helping out and doing light rolls with the white belts, I'm going to be a part of it. Cause it's another great community, like first response or surfing or lifeguarding, that it just helps your other part of your life.
I couldn't agree more. All right. Well, then for people listening, where can they find the books, Never Off Duty, and any other places you want to direct them to?
So neveroffduty.org, you can buy the Barefoot Brigade book there or on Amazon. All the funds go to, it's like a Tom Shoe. You buy one, we give one. So we roll it in. So say the book is $5, it costs around $250 to produce. We purchase another one, give it out to a school. We do have equipment on there. We have gear. We're coming out with different like funny t-shirts. Like we've got Listen to Metal and Save Lives, like all these just funny t-shirts, like one-offs, more for the lifeguards, because lifeguarding is kind of a community like that. My book's on Amazon. My new book, I'm doing it totally differently. I already have the outline and I'm shopping it. I want someone to produce it the right way and get not bootstrap, but I want it to be done the right way, because the end goal is to give people skill sets, but also to save lives downstream. So I want to make sure that I can get the revenue and do the right thing with it. And if I'm going to put my life and expose all the things that I've been through and how I've managed it and how I've learned, I want there to be a net benefit to multiple people. So I have to do it strategically. So that's not going to be out probably until spring of next year, I would say, but look for it. And I'm sure it'll get somewhere.
Brilliant. Well, I want to thank you again. I mean, you know, we've obviously gone back and forth since the first interview, and your family has been through some incredibly hard times. And I'm so glad to hear that everything's looking really good again. But I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Oh, appreciate it. And good luck with everything. You're doing a great job. We appreciate what you do.